Welcome to the A10 Talk Podcast. I'm Sam Basil, and today we are joined by a pretty large crew. This is our first, our first five analyst show of the season, so that's really exciting. Of course, I'm joined alongside Daniel Frank, David Korn, Kaylee Godek, and Michael Bergman for the first time on the podcast. Michael, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, Sam. It's good to be here. You know, it's been a great start to conference play for some teams, some a little rough start there, but, you know, it's really good to just, you know, break down what's going on right now, a lot going on. A lot of new teams kind of in the middle and top of those standings there that we haven't seen in a while, you know, trying to get familiar with some pronunciations of their names maybe, or, you know, just finding out where this team has been all along. But, you know, it's we're a couple games, like 9-10 games in the conference play now, and it's time to really get down to see who's been the pretenders and who is really here for real.
Yeah, 9-10 games. Some teams, I would say, like, yeah, some teams have played as little as 6. Some teams have played as much as 9. Like you said, it's crazy to think that we're pretty much halfway over. We're halfway done the conference play, halfway to Brooklyn. So first, you know, been wanting to have you on for a while this season, but I wanted to have you on especially tonight because I feel like there was something that was going on that kind of generated a really interesting discussion. I think a really valuable discussion, right, on A10 Talk that kind of not only translates to just college basketball, but I feel like right now sports and a lot of other things in general, and that's kind of like the current relationship, you know, whether it be caused by, you know, the prevalence of social media, kind of coming out of the pandemic a little bit, I think has affected a little bit. And that's the relationship between players and coaches, fans, and the media, the press. So there was a press conference where, you know, you asked Frank Martin a question about lineups. He responded saying it was a social media question. And obviously, you know, you posted another video today. It seems like you guys kind of reconciled a little bit. And are able to kind of move the discussion forward a little bit. But could you kind of just break down the situation a little bit and kind of explain what happened initially?
Yeah, certainly, Sam. So it all started a little last week after UMass lost their game at VCU. It was little frustrations in that game, especially in the second half, the way I guess it was kind of managed from a clock management standpoint. They had gone into the half kind of VCU had on a run there, and they kind of continued in the second half. And, you know, they kind of went on a run for these couple of minutes, like 16-2 run over like 5-minute stretch, and Frank didn't call timeout. And, you know, there are people on Twitter kind of feeling, you know, not just Twitter, but, you know, kind of all around feeling like UMass not threw in the towel. That's not really the right word, but more just like, you know, didn't keep their foot on the pedal there. People were pretty concerned about that. So moving in that after that Tuesday game, there was a lot of kind of ill feelings there. And then you get to Thursday, which there was like the next press conference, I guess, before their UMass next game, which was, you know, that Saturday against St. Joe's. And Frank had referenced that he had heard from a couple of his players some personal attacks from people on Twitter, not based on like, you know, lineup construction or substitution pattern, but specific attacks aimed at players, you know, kind of hurt some hurtful remarks. And that's what Frank was really upset about in his press conference. And he was like, I had never seen this before at his previous stops in South Carolina and Kansas State, these type of attacks. And, you know, he wasn't, you know, he said there was only a little group of people, wasn't everyone who was doing that. And he said, you can come at me for my lineup construction, my substitution pattern. That's all fair game. But when it comes to personal attacks, that was where it crossed the line. And he wanted to make that very clear. You know, and then he went on a rant for like 6-7 minutes there. And it was like a pretty, like, you never really hear a coach do that publicly. It's usually you do that type of things behind the scenes and you don't kind of, you know, mesh between that line there. And, you know, I thought that kind of talk, so that wasn't really something that came out really on social media. We kind of didn't really want that stuff to get out there or anything, or just kind of, you know, I just didn't think, personally, I didn't think that was really in the best interest of anyone for something like that on a really personal basis to kind of get out there. So we fast forward to the game after Saturday. You know, UMass had another loss at St. Joe's. And you know, it was interesting because of that game, that second half, they opened with a different lineup than they did to start the game, and that was the first time all season that Frank Martin had done that, at least to my knowledge. You know, decision to do that, you know, to change the lineup up. So it was also something where, you know, you get curious if something like that happened. So basically, after the game, you're gonna want to like know what happened. To that, you know, substitution pattern. So, you know, politely asked, like, hey, they start RJ Lewis in the second half and, you know, not, you know, Brandon Barden. All I asked was about RJ, you know, then he went on a 9-2 run to start the half and he kind of shot it down a little bit, called it a quote unquote social media question. But you know what? Based on the frustration of the game, I can totally understand like how it would come off like that. It wasn't really ill intent towards, you know, me or anyone else in the media. It really felt that it was kind of like a boiling over frustration kind of a thing. You know, so I guess another one of the guest reporters tweeted about that and about the whole press conference rant from that Thursday. And it kind of spurred UMass Twitter quite a bit. A lot of people took it, just to say the least, everyone, you know, kind of took it a little personally, maybe more than I thought they would, just based on the outset of the comments and the quotes, seeing it kind of out of context really probably didn't really just give it the light it deserved in terms of, you know, what it was meant to do in the beginning. Because it was really about some personal attacks about players. It wasn't about Frank being, you know, people on Twitter criticizing his patterns and all that. And, you know, I think, you know, anyone on social media has the right to have their opinion. You know, I don't think he was like trying to silence anyone or anything like that. I really think, if you look at the crux of it, I think he was really just going after like a couple people, and it kind of blew up into this whole thing as he was going after people's right to question him on some things. And that's where this call kind of started. But I think it's kind of behind everyone now, especially in the program and in the UMass. I think he addressed at the start today, today being, you know, Tuesday in the his presser today, kind of just he kind of apologized the way he went about it in the beginning, and you know, said that it wasn't the right thing how to address that question. He shouldn't have shut it down like that and moved on. And you know, there's no hard feelings here. I honestly totally get it. You know, what was going on. You know, I'd never really take any of that stuff personally, just from, you know, a media standpoint. Like everyone's there doing their jobs and all that. And you know, if he doesn't want to answer a question, it's totally fine. You know, and you know, honestly, I wasn't even that totally offended the way he answered it, because earlier in the week he had kind of addressed that similar type of lining about don't not questioning the substitution stuff. So if you go off what it takes, you know, you could see it that way as well. But you know, there's a lot of different opinions on this. Some people are probably might take a harsher stance, saying like, you know, why he shouldn't be questioning everything and all that. But I'd love to hear your guys' kind of takes on what you kind of guys saw from afar. Not, you know, mostly not being UMass centric people, just based on like what you thought. You know, how the arguments kind of swayed on Twitter and like what your personal beliefs on Frank's comments.
Yeah, so and anyone else, you know, feel free to hop in here. Like, it's honestly, it's, you know, it was definitely an interesting situation, right? And I feel like it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, even before, you know, I saw all this stuff on Twitter. And I feel like I kind of have two takeaways from it, right? We are in an age where, for better or for worse, I mean, fans, media, everyone is able to have a platform, right? Everyone is able to get their takes out, and have it seen by a lot of people, including the people that those takes are about, right? Whether it be a team, player, coach, on a professional or college level. And that's great because, you know, people like us, you know, we can build a following off that. We can, you know, join a community like that. The problem is now everyone can see it, right? And so you're bringing people into the discussion, and I feel like because of that, these players and these coaches and these programs now are also active participants in that discussion. And I think people are still adjusting to that a little bit. I mean, you especially see it in something like the NBA, where, you know, there's a lot of fan interactions, and, you know, a player might go back at a fan, and a lot of people end up being like, whoa, like, I haven't really experienced that before. You know, I haven't really had a player like trash talk back to me. But at the same time, like, I feel like that should be expected, right? I mean, I feel like if we're going to continue having this discussion with the ease and the access that we continue to gain, I don't see why anyone should be surprised that a coach might actually hop into the debate, a player might actually hop into the debate. And I think at the end of the day, I mean, you know, not, I honestly think your question was incredibly fair, which brings it to kind of my second point in sometimes people don't see eye to eye on these things. And I really just think that the fans and the media and coaches and players, the reason why they might not see eye to eye on those things is because they're looking at the games and these sports in general in a completely different way, right? Like me, right? I've watched a ton of basketball my entire life. The last time I played basketball on an organized team was third grade. There are probably things that I'm seeing that I, you know, I might ask a coach about, and they're looking at it a completely different way than me. I've asked questions in plenty of press conferences from, you know, a multitude of teams and coaches, like, hey, what was the motivation behind that? Were you trying to do this? And they go, absolutely not. That is the opposite of what I was trying to do. Blah, 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 blah. And like you, I mean, I'm just like, oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. I wasn't even looking at it like that. But of course, you know, when these clips kind of come out, people think, oh, there's beef. There's Bergman, Frank, Martin beef. And sometimes it's just, it can get a little silly. But I think it's really interesting. And I'm honestly, like, I hope people start realizing, like, look, like, the discussion is just getting a lot, well, it's not, we don't want it to get personal, but it's becoming a lot more transparent. You know what I mean? And I feel like, you know, there were some comments. There was an interesting quote from Coach Caputo for GW as well that I feel like, you know, Daniel and David, both of you probably have a lot of thoughts on.
Yeah, I mean, I was at that press conference because that was right after the Dayton win. And that was the first thing he said. You know, didn't talk about the game, anything. He said, I want to open this up by talking about this because I think it was especially relevant for GW because after GW beat George Mason, Brendan Adams received a death threat on Instagram. And it wasn't like, I'm going to kill you. But it was like one of those things from a burner where I can find it somewhere, but it was basically just like, hope you die, whatever. And so I think now it's pretty clear that was from a gambler. And Caputo was just not happy about that. And I think it's one of those things where I think the head coaches here are more, they are more fair game than the players in this case. Because again, it's college. These are children. These are students. These are not professionals. The coach, I feel like there can be more criticism towards them. There can be more personal sort of criticisms towards the coach. But anything that has to do with the players, I think, is really out of line, more than just stating facts. Something I've heard from sports journalists before is that people can't get mad if you're talking about facts, saying, oh, this is a statistical output of a player. Let's say they're having a really bad night. It's okay to talk about that bad night. But once it starts getting personal, you know, once you like start piling on someone, then it can get iffy. And so I just think it's all about that. But yeah, Caputo was not happy about that. He wanted to make sure he addressed it, and he appreciated that there was more of a conversation about it because he had definitely had some issues in regards to these sort of attacks.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. It's and kind of circling between all three of you, with just the blurring of lines, and like there's so much, and it sounds stupid to say, but it's obvious there's so much ease of access of communication now in a way that, like, you know, in the past, someone couldn't just, you know, if you want to get in touch with someone across the country from you, you know, you'd have to like call them up on the phone or something. And like now you can just slide in a guy's DMs and be like, you know, F you, like, you know, you blew my parlay for me or whatever. Which obviously anytime anyone goes after a kid like that is terrible. The weird flip side too of the way that this works the other ways, I know of, and I've heard through various sources, I've seen it firsthand, a number of players who will intentionally, like on Twitter after every single game, will search their name and try to see what people are saying about them, which creates a different dynamic too, where it's like, you're posting onto this public forum, and obviously people use Twitter in different social medias in different ways. Journalists even use it in different ways. It's a great point. David, saying Breon Freeman. Yeah, I mean, that's a great example of a guy who, you know, early on this season, GW fans were kind of giving it to him a little bit on social media. He didn't respond super great. He, like, deleted his account for a couple days. Like, there's the weird interactions there with, like, the players that, you know, a lot of them are young kids and, you know, they're dealing with being in the spotlight for the first time. And just that back and forth, just a weird dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, I think you bring up a great point about players, you know, searching their names on Twitter. And I think when you're a college player or a high school player, I think it's a pretty valid thing to do, right? Because at the end of the day, look, high school basketball, college basketball is not the final goal for so many of these players. These players want to make sure that, hey, if I'm putting out a good performance, let me see what my coverage is like so I can, you know, see how it's affecting my draft stock. But if I'm a player and I just see, you know, people going, oh my God, like you did not hit over 6.5 rebounds. Like, ugh, like what does that do? Like, how does that, like, I guess the question is like, if you're going to put out a take, like you said, David, like you can't really argue with facts, but at the same time, like, what is your point that you're making, like, doing to further the discussion, right? Like, what new information is that bring to light? Like, what rebuttal are you trying to make? And sometimes, you know, and everyone, like, you can always be funny. Like, there are a lot of people, especially on 810 Twitter, that are really funny, but they know how to, like, toe the line, you know? So
the one thing I want to ask you, Bergman, about, there was, and I don't know the full context of this, but there was something that was getting circulated around UMass Twitter about Frank Martin saying he wanted to fight some people. I don't know if that was in the context of talking bad about players or if that was with other things, but what's the story with that?
Yeah, so that was basically, so in his original rant, like the 6-7 minute rant that he had last Thursday, that kind of started this whole, you know, I guess incident. I don't even call it an incident because nothing really happened, you know, in person. It was all online. But he had mentioned that, you know, as he was rambling on, that he, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he said something about the fact that if you want to, like, pick a fight with me, like, come to my office and, like, we'll talk about it in person. We'll do it out in the parking lot. He uses these old time expressions, you know, like that he, you know, he face to face, man to man, you know, put the hands up and let's fight it out. You know, I think he uses an expression. He literally didn't mean he was actually going to fight anyone, physically or even verbally. But the only thing is he did mention he had actually reached out to people who had made these comments to the players. And he says he wanted to invite them and just have a discussion about it. Whether that actually is true, I don't know. I mean, I guess I got to take him at his word and saying he actually did. And, you know, maybe there are people going to be showing up at his office talking it out. But, you know, I think that was just more of a hyperbole thing. I don't actually think there was really people fighting or they were threatening anyone to fight. And, you know, I think a lot of it, Frank Martin, you know, as he's new to the conference, but you've seen, he's a guy who really speaks his mind. And, you know, he's I don't want to say he's driven by emotion, because that could be a really dangerous word to say, but he really, like, speaks on his emotions a lot. So, like, after a game, you can tell, like, if he'll be, like, not completely different, but, like, the way he goes about answering questions will be different before a game than he is, you know, right after a game, because, you know, his, I guess, I don't maybe it's not his mood's dictated by the outcome of the game, but the way he has been dictated to me, it certainly is. So, again, you know, if the team starts performing well, maybe he'll get some a different type of Frank Martin. But, you know, based on the first, 20 almost games, that's kind of what we've been seeing from him.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it definitely seemed like, in retrospect, now that cooler heads have prevailed, like one of those sound bites that kind of developed a life of its own. So that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the end of the day, like, we're all here to have a discussion, but I mean, sometimes people just get a little too crazy. And speaking of crazy tweets, about 2 days ago, David, for our next segment. So 2 days ago, you tweeted, there is a real chance the A-10 player of the year, James Bishop, Most Improved Player, Brendan Adams, Rookie of the Year, Max Edwards, and Coach of the Year, Chris Caputo, are all GW. That would be insane.
I don't agree on Most Improved Player.
Well, let's hold up real quick. Let's hold up real quick. So for our next segment, I kind of wanted to do a bit of a conference court where David and Daniel, because you're not an innocent party here. I know you're a GW gasser upper. You're the defendants. Kaylee and Michael, I'd like you kind of to be the plaintiffs in the first edition of what I'd kind of like to call conference court. So, David, if you could kind of provide an opening statement for, you know, some of these claims and maybe any more GW claims that you might have. Daniel, you as well. You know, and Michael and Kaylee, you know, do your best to kind of break it down, provide some rebuttals, and we'll see, you know, what kind of common ground we can come to here.
So I'd like to start out by saying I don't think this will happen. I'm saying I'm like Doctor Strange right now. I'm saying, like, there is a world in which this happens. GW finds itself in fourth place with a double bye. You know, they have a pretty easy schedule here on out. I'm going to get into that later. I have that all prepared. But they have a pretty easy schedule here on out. Let's say that they find themselves in fourth place with a double bye in Brooklyn. James Bishop's scoring output stays the same. Brendan Adams, you know, is top five in the conference in scoring like he is. Max Edwards keeps racking up Rookie of the Weeks and, you know, is the clear top rookie there. Why wouldn't this happen? You know what I mean? This is the clear top player in the conference. The clearly most improved player, Brendan Adams' scoring has jumped up like 10 points. Max Edwards is right now the only rookie averaging more than 10 points, and he's a starter on the fourth place team in the conference. And then Caputo, people had GW ranked 12th. If they end the season fourth, and the three teams above him would be VCU, Dayton, SLU, I'm assuming, in this hypothetical, none of those teams would have overachieved. That's where everyone thought they would be, in the 1-2-3 spot, anywhere around there. It just makes sense to me, and I think it's a crazy, crazy situation that GW could have that sweep. But yes, I encourage rebuttals. I have lots of stats and other sort of information to back up my claims. Hit me.
So if I can kind of fact check you before we get into anybody else. So right now, GW, like you said, fourth in the league. Looking at their remaining schedule, the current top three, the only remaining game that GW has against any of those other two teams being VCU, Dayton, and SLU is VCU on March 4th. You know, their regular season finale.
And there's a good chance that their fate could be sealed by then, so they wouldn't have much to play for.
And so basically what you're saying is not that you're going to put down a parlay for all of this to happen, but what you're saying is, if I may kind of, you know, kind of break down what you're saying is, there's a clear path to each of those things that you've listed. Is that fair to say?
Yes, along with GW getting the double bye.
Okay. Daniel, before we kind of get into – I see Michael kind of making a face here, so I know this is going to be good. Daniel, is there anything you kind of want to add here?
Yes. I agree wholeheartedly with David. I don't have a whole ton to say that David hasn't already outlined. I think GW's hardest remaining game on the schedule is the road game at Bona, truthfully. Just because VCU is a loss. That's always going to be a loss. GW's not won at VCU since...
That's a home game. That's a home game.
Oh, it is?
Yep.
And it's the last game of the season.
Well, then scratch that. Then, yeah, the road game at Bona is definitely the hardest game on the schedule left for GW. My biggest concern is the St. Joe's game tomorrow night, which by the time this gets posted may already have gone final. But GW needs to avoid a rebound loss like they had after the road loss at Radford after they beat South Carolina. They need to avoid that. But GW, just if you look at the talent level, top to bottom of the eight guys on the roster, scholarship guys on the roster, the best talent GW's had since 2017, each of these guys are the case. I mean, there's a strong case for Ricky Lindo Jr. as Defensive Player of the Year, just based off what he did on Deron Holmes alone as a secondary defender with Hunter Dean together. And there's a case for Brendan Adams. I mean, find me a guy who has done better. Brendan Adams, I was frustrated with last year. I did not like watching at times last year. He is now a guy that I want the ball in his hands. Like, talk about jumps that people have made. Complete. And James Bishop. If James Bishop doesn't win player of the year in this conference, it's rigged. It's just straight up. James Bishop is the best player in this conference. And Chris Caputo, look, I know he's not going to win coach of the year, because if anyone deserved it, it was what's his face from Fordham last year. I'm blanking on his name, Sam. We all agree that he should have won it, and it went to McKillop probably as a, like a going away career achievement award.
Oh, in Neptune?
Retrospect. Yes. We all were in agreement last year that Neptune should have won it. And that's the same reason that Caputo probably won't win it. But if you just look at like getting the most out of your roster, he's got eight guys, and he's making it work. So
there are eight scholarship players who are not injured. If there's an injury, it's bad news, but GW is only down to eight
players. You mean
players,
a fourth injury?
Eight players before they have to go to Laziz Talipov, who I'm sure none of you guys know who he is, but it's a, that'd be a tough look.
All right, so I think you've laid out a pretty strong case. Daniel, you doubled down. James Bishop has to win player of the year. So Kaylee, Michael, starting off with you, Kaylee, what point did they make right there that kind of sticks out to you the most where you have to say, nope? And in replacement, what do you got for him?
I'm going to disagree on most improved player of the year. I think DeAndre Dominguez of UMass has had a really good season this year. He's really improved from his freshman and sophomore years up at UMass, considering the amount of playing time he was getting. He definitely has like upped his game and can play like really well and is doing like amazing. I can't really like do any, like he's been awesome. Like he, granted, there's been times where he's wanted to go after refs about some calls, but it happens to the best of us. It gets to every player, especially if it's a tight game. But I mean, like, I could see Caputo being coach of the year. It also, like, I have seen too, like, it does tend to line up with who is the regular season champion. So, like, it could end up, if it's VCU still, as the Mike Rhodes could get it. It always lines up, I've noticed, on both the men's and women's side, that it can go to that coach. But I can also see that they did it for McKillop last year just because it was his last year, really.
I feel like Dominguez, it's tough for him to be most improved, though. He plays like he doesn't even play 18 minutes a night. Like, I don't feel like that's really – sure, he could have had a good year, but I feel like that doesn't necessarily put you in play for a end-of-season award.
Michael, it seemed like you had something off that point.
All right. Well, y'all make really good points. And I have to, you know, as a UMass person, first, let me say, you know, there's an inherent bias here, but I do, you know, I saw the tweet and my first instinct was like, all right, Brendan Adams, you know, sounds like some, you know, I remember him at UConn and all my friends hating on him. So how much better could he have gotten? So, you know, I looked through the numbers, you know, I had tried to do the homework and you know what? I have to agree with David. He is undoubtedly the most improved player in the Atlantic 10. And honestly, there's a lot of great candidates this week, but this year, but I don't even think it's close. Like I don't. If you look at his numbers, his production, I got some stats here I could throw you right at you. From last year to this year, I mean, his minutes haven't gone up significantly and went from 30 to like 30, almost 7 a game. His points have more than doubled. His field goals attempted per game have gone up by about 4.5, but his percentage was last year, shooting 38% last year. This year, 47.6. 3-point percentage last year was 27.2. This year, 35.1. He's attempting more than double his free throws. His percentage has gone up from 78% to 87%. His rebounds gone up by 1. His assists gone up by about 1 to like 3. Steals about the same, about 0.6, and turnovers have gone up a little, but that's understandably because his usage rate has skyrocketed by about 10% there. You know, just looking at his numbers, they're incredible, but, you know, to go off to DeAndre Dominguez, I think he's very worthy, and he'll definitely be in consideration for that award based on his – he went from, like, a bench player getting fringe minutes last year on a team that was desperately trying to win games to – a really core important part of a rebuild. So if you want to, in terms of like most important improved player, I think DeAndre Dominguez means more to UMass than like Adams does to GW. I can argue that in terms of like per game importance. But, you know, I think the award that DeAndre Dominguez would be more suitable for probably be sixth man of the year. I would probably definitely have him winning that right now. If you look at people coming off the bench, I think his production, because Ceeson hasn't started a game this year, and Adams started every one. So I think that would be probably the most suitable award if you want to put Dominguez in there. But I mean, Brendan Adams he's made himself into an all-league player. And DeAndre Dominguez has, you know, if you want to have those two at the top of that race, I mean, I think there are others worthy too, but if you want to compare it between those two, I just think that if you take each of their leaps, I think, you know, Dominguez has gone up like a good amount, but Adams has like almost doubled that. And it's just, if you look at the numbers, it's just really hard to ignore that. And also, you know what? You look at the wins and losses too, and that adds up. And you got the eye test, you got the numbers on the table. And my vote goes to Brendan Adams for, at this point, the most improved player in the Atlantic 10.
So it seems like, at least on the player's side, the plaintiffs are pretty much in agreement with the defendants. I mean, at least, you know, they're not conceding complete ground. But, I mean, I think, Michael and Kaylee, it seems like you guys also see that those pathways are there. So the next question is, and I feel like this kind of pertains to another discussion that we've had a couple times on this podcast, Caputo for Coach of the Year, and GW securing that double bye. Caputo, obviously, I mean, GW is in the top four right now, based on the way things are going with this conference, by no fault of their own, more just by, you know, just the dominance of teams like VCU, Dayton, and St. Louis. They're probably not going to be hanging a regular season championship banner. And that achievement has almost kind of been, like we've said, kind of almost been an unwritten requirement of Coach of the Year for you know, the Atlantic 10. Is there anything Caputo can do aside from, you know, just keep getting quality wins that can secure him that kind of that award? And is there any way that anything he can do this season that might have you putting his name in that spot on maybe like an end of year ballot?
The biggest thing is in the preseason poll, GW is ranked 12th. Last year, Caputo, this team, from a statistical output at the beginning of the season, was objectively worse than the team last year. This team has been playing so much better. Every single player in GW's rotation is having a career year. Caputo's been talking about that. He knows that they're playing better than they've ever played in their lives. I don't see how you cannot, because you talked about the Neptune thing. What was Fordham last year? Eight?
Eight.
Sam?
Yeah.
Eight. There's a big difference between four and eight. Because I understand Fordham was projected a pillow fight team, just like GW was projected a pillow fight team this year. I feel like if they make the jump from projected pillow fight to four, with the other storylines, as in it was pretty much the same team that was last year, with such a better product on the court. You know, every single player is having their best statistical season. He might have turned James Bishop into a legitimate NBA prospect. I feel like this is a situation that could buck the trend of it just going to the regular season champion, especially if I think Dayton or St. Louis is the team that comes out on top, because those teams were projected to be 1 and 2. I think if VCU gets one, I think Rhodes will get it. I'm not stupid. I think that'll happen. But again, because the expectations were so high for St. Louis and Dayton going into the year, and I know St. Louis is playing pretty well right now, but they've been disappointing so far. I really think that Caputo leading a GW team to fourth would get a lot of recognition.
And so the prosecution, I mean, the two of you, I've got my gavel now.
Is that from a Model UN conference?
Actually, it was for my fantasy football league's auction draft.
I love it.
The prosecution, is there anything that these top three coaches can do? I mean, you know, Ford, Rhodes, Grant. Is there anything special they can do aside from winning the regular season championship that has them as a definite coach of the year, in your opinion?
I mean, Rhodes has had several good years at VCU, so him being very consistent and actually winning regular season this year, I think would put him like over the fact. And if he wins regular season, which is currently looking like that, but I'm not going that far in saying that it will happen. But with how well that VCU has been doing, I think since they're now fully healthy and they have Baldwin back from all of his wrist injuries, I think that Rhodes can come away with it for sure. Ford, I don't know if you can necessarily, like, yes, the expectations were high. I don't think you can necessarily say he can come away with the regular season championship, even though he only has that one loss, and that one loss being to UMass. As of right now, there's still plenty of time left in conference play that could shake things up completely and could really move the top four, could move the pillow fight teams, could move just everything in conference play that is unexpected. The chaos lives within conference play. So you never know what could happen for coach of the year or player of the year.
And so, Michael, for you, the last question I have, the double bye. I think the schedule, aside from that final VCU game and that away game at St. Bonaventure, it looks pretty good for GW. But right now in the standings, I mean, they're only a half game up from three teams: Mason, who they've already beat, Richmond, and St. Bonaventure. They're only a game up in the standings from 3-3 Fordham. Is there anybody in that kind of four-team little group that I just said there, and even possibly lower, that UC could potentially beat them for a top four spot?
I mean, I definitely see any of them, because this is a very weak between, like, teams, I want to say, like, four and, like, eight. It's like one of the weakest 4-8s I've seen in a long time. Like,
I mean, we knew that going in.
Well, no, I mean, going to this season, we thought the 4-8 would be one of the strongest ever. You know, I mean, if you look preseason projections, you know, there was tons of hype. This team could have been a 3-bid league, maybe 4-bid league, and there was going to be a 100 NIT hype. And I think a lot of that was kind of killed in the non-conference play. But and you know, but I think you're seeing all the top dogs who are supposed to be are starting to really now starting to carry like the league, the VCU, Dayton, St. Louis. Like, those three were like the top three going in, like, pretty clearly. And now they're still kind of at the top. At least they haven't had a significant bad loss of any sign, like some home loss against like the worst of the Loyolas or something like that. Unfortunately, sorry to diss Loyola, but you know, we don't want to bring them in this conversation. We're talking about GW here. So honestly, you know, to go back to your previous, I guess, question about the Caputo, you know, if there's something that can unravel a potential pathway there. I mean, you know, there's not a lot of tough road going ahead, which is great. But I think what could be even more worrisome is there's not a lot of high level games, which means that, like, just thinking theoretically, like, if they lose a game, it most likely could be to one of the bottom tier teams. There's a lot more bad losses potentially at head than great wins. And that can sometimes, especially for a lesser known coach, really derail a season, because they have the big wins, right? Mason, they got Dayton this week. So, like, you know, they really got those on the resume there. But now you're trying to avoid that really bad loss. And if you look at their schedule, I'm looking here, they got 12 games left. 9 out of the 12 are Q3 games, and the other 3 are Q4 games, quad 4. You know, so there's, and again, you know, it's mostly because there's not a lot of great teams in the Atlantic 10 this year in terms of net rankings, but you really wanted to avoid the home losses against, like, you know, St. Joe's tomorrow, that's, or today, or whenever you're listening. That's going to be like a must win. Like, I know they're 3-5, 3-4, or whatever, but like, if you can't beat them at home, it just kind of almost cancels out, like, what you just did against Dayton. You know, it really does. And it's as much as you want to think about it, but because people just are thinking of, like, what's happened, the latest, what your latest loss or win is. And people are just going to be like, oh, they lost at home to St. Joe's on a Wednesday night. You know, it's like, they're just celebrating over Dayton, and you know the storyline's going to derail from what a great positive momentum that is. And you know, if you look farther down the slate, that home game against LaSalle, February 25th, Saturday, like, you know, that's like, that scares, that can scare the crap out of you. Like, can't lose. There's a lot more like, you can't lose this games now than like, must, you know, we got to steal one on the road, which is great to have in a position for George Washington, especially where they've started expectations wise. But that's, I think, what could derail a potential coach of the year candidate is one of those bad losses in the team that like, going in, you were at, your mind was at ease going and being like, this is a sure win. But no, it's not. You just lost to LaSalle on a Saturday, and now your hands are in your head, and you're, you know, your double buys in jeopardy potentially.
So I went back. I went back and I did some research. If you end the season with five losses, that pretty much guarantees you at least number four in the conference. GW right now is sitting at 4-2, have already played probably their two toughest games. With the remaining schedule, I definitely think they can get through that with three losses. Because again, I think that affords them one like trap game. You know what I mean? Whether that's St. Joe's, the St. Joe's game, whatever, whenever you're listening to this, whether that's the LaSalle game you were talking about, going up to Fordham, I think that's always difficult to play up there. Whatever that trap game you consider it is, fine. There's one of them. And then the matchups I consider to be kind of tougher, which are hosting George Mason, hosting Richmond, hosting Duquesne, going away to State Bonaventure, hosting VCU. If you can go 3-2 there with, again, penciling in one bad loss, I think that's totally doable. So they don't have to be perfect to get the four spot. They need to just stay on track, and I definitely think they can do that. So, again, one bad loss, again, not ideal, but that still doesn't kill this at all.
The other thing I would piggyback off of that and say is I think it's a different mentality when you're chasing fourth place because, I mean, I know there was a quote that you posted, David, after the Dayton win. It's like there's no one in the locker room that thinks that they can't win an A-10 title, which very well could be true. But I feel like the mental approach is different when you're not so desperate to get an at-large bid. Like, GW is not in an at-large conversation. They're years away from that. But, like, I feel like that's where you see the most conference pressure when you start looking over your shoulder the most. Just like, you know, like if in years past, like we've had like Dayton teams go on the road and lose disastrous games to LaSalle and Fordham, and like they're constantly looking over their shoulder. And I feel like that's where a lot of those games come in. I feel like it's a different mental approach right now for GW just because they're playing with house money. They literally have nothing to lose. I mean, we all thought they'd be playing on Tuesday night in Brooklyn because it's now on Tuesday apparently. But like, I mean, basically the worst case scenario here for GW is they play one extra game, which like the odds of GW winning the A-10 tournament are still low, even if they get a top four seed, but like it's possible. And like, I don't feel like there's that big of a risk for GW to like, yeah, okay, they finish fifth or sixth. Like, I know it, like the double bye means a lot, but it's also not everything. And I feel like I don't feel like that's where this team's head is at. And that's a gut feeling. It's part of it is just from talking to coaches and whatnot around the program. I'm not concerned about that at all with them looking over their shoulder. They'll probably lose some stupid games. They'll probably win some stupid games. But like, GW is going to end up where they're going to end up because that's what they're meant to be, not because they were looking over their shoulder.
So I feel like we've heard a lot of good arguments. We've pulled out a lot of great stats, honestly, about scheduling and history. I feel like, honestly, I learned a lot. And so now I've come to make my ruling. Watching A-10 basketball, knowing how these programs work, I feel like no matter what, sometimes the odds might be stacked against GW a little bit, but looking at their schedule, seeing these performances, looking at, you know, potentially being forced to change our criteria for things like Coach of the Year, I think I am going to have to agree that the pathways are there. And I think that's something that both plaintiffs and defendants can agree on. So I would like to close this first ruling in the inaugural conference court. All right. So let's kind of wrap it up into our.
I just want to say this very quickly before we wrap up. GW, I'm going through the Hunger Games right now, I'm going to say, may the odds ever be in your favor. That's all I'm going to say. May the odds ever be in your favor.
And I respond to that. Hail to the buff, buff. Hail to the blue, blue. Hail to the buff.
All right, so that was a great way to end that segment. So let's get into our final thing of the night. I feel like this was a bit of an early podcast that we kind of recorded, like, weekday-wise. And that kind of leaves a lot of A10 basketball to speculate on and just kind of plan our weekly watching itineraries. So let's just go around. Everyone give me, you know, one or two games on either the men's or women's side that you think everyone should be checking out this week, starting with you, Michael, because this is the first time you've been able to do this season.
Yeah, I think, you know, starting off, I guess, tomorrow's interesting. Just, you know, I guess, or Wednesday, I guess, really. The VCU-Mason game is a little more intriguing this year because VCU is now kind of, after a week after that Dayton win, kind of solidified themselves at the top of the standings. You know, there was always a threat that Dayton was going to take it back the next game or there was a letdown. But VCU hasn't had that letdown, like, right after that huge game, which could be expected for a team that's kind of feeling themselves there. And now they're at home against the Mason team that honestly, like, you know, they've been very up and down this season. But when they're up, you know, like, they're really, you know, a really, I don't know if I can curse on here, but they're really a bitch to freaking to play with, you know, Noduro and those guys down there. And honestly, you know, all the games are 7 o'clock tomorrow or today, whenever you listen to this. There's six games, and I think that has the most intrigue because I think that's just going to be like a rock fight to like solidify and grasp. I think that's going to be a 2-1 possession game going down the stretch. So that's my game during the week. And if you look forward to the weekend, you know, I think again that Richmond Dayton's kind of interesting too. I think it's like a 4 o'clock on Saturday. That's you know, Richmond's going to be on this their second straight road game, and Dayton's going to be playing. I think they're at Rodita and then home against Richmond. So, you know, that's going to be like both teams could be coming off a loss or a win. Both teams coming off a win. So they want to end their week strong. I always find it really interesting. Both teams have like a 2 or 1 game winning streak during that week. And then they play each other and then seeing like who's going to end the week with the most momentum. Because, you know, the A10, you always got that Wednesday, the Saturday stretch there. And honestly, like, how you end your week really makes you feel a lot different of how you start the week.
Yeah, that's a pretty crucial stretch considering, like, how I feel like the NBA. The A10 is, you know, kind of paced their schedule this year. Great picks. David, what you got for us?
I like the Friday 10 matchup between Davidson and St. Louis. I feel like Davidson's lost a lot of squeakers lately. I feel like they've played up to opponents like we saw them play up to Purdue earlier in the year. I think this could be a really good opportunity at home for them to kind of get an upset win. And I think that one will be a lot of fun. And I know St. Louis is doing well. Perkins is finally looking like himself again and all of that. But I just think, I don't know what it is about Davidson. I always just think they have a shot. And I think that could be a really fun one. I think it'll be close. And I think it'll be really cool to see if they do get that sort of finally elusive good win. And another game I'm looking forward to is Fordham State Bonaventure on Wednesday. I think that could be another really interesting game. I know St. Bonaventure has been really good at home, and I think what they're like, they've only lost one game at home and they've lost every game on the road, but they just probably lost their one of, if not their worst road game of the season at Loyola. And so I see if they can bounce back. Fordham, see if they can get a good win. I don't know. I just think that'll be a fun one to watch as well. So those are kind of the two I have circled. I know I didn't want to piggyback off of you, Bergman, but yeah, those are the ones I have.
Yeah, that that Fordham St. Bonaventure, I believe, sets up the first part of a home and home this year. So I mean, I feel like the first matchup in a home and home, always a great pick. And yeah, I feel like it's going to be closer than a lot of people think. I mean, Bonnies right now, the books have 5 points on the Bonnies, and I think that's a very fair margin. Daniel, yeah, what
I'm
you got
also
for us?
Down on St. Bonaventure overall. So I just think that, again, a lot of their success is just teams having to travel to them, and that's really difficult. And so, you know, it's a tough place to play. And so I'm not sure. I know they've had a good conference slate, but I haven't bought in. So every chance I have to try and buy in even more, I am looking to.
Very fair. Daniel, what you got for us?
I'll do a nice little setup of the weekend on the women's side for y'all. Got a couple interesting games here. The top three, I think, has really established itself after what we saw with last weekend. You got Rhodey, UMass, and Fordham in order. And I think there's a pretty good gap right now down between four is up for grabs and all the way down, basically four through nine, I think, is on the table for just about anybody in that group. I'll be looking at specifically, I think Mason Davidson is a really interesting one. Davidson is knocking on the door. They're at fifth place right now. Mason has been very good at home and very poor on the road. So Mason does get Davidson at home. I think that's a very important game for the standings. Sunday, I think Duquesne UMass at UPMC's event center, or whatever they call it these days, I think is a really interesting game. Duquesne coming off a very emotional loss to Davidson on Sunday. Tess Myers was sensational. I know UMass is kind of hitting their stride right now, but that's a tough roadie for UMass to hit there. And I also think Richmond St. Joe's on Sunday as well is really interesting. Richmond is a team that really hit a rut there in late December, early January, but I think is slowly starting to put the pieces together. And St. Joe's has now lost three straight after a brilliant start to both non-con and to conference play. So two teams kind of go in different directions. Those are the three games that I'll be having my eye on this weekend. Kaylee, what you got?
So I'm also staying on the women's side here. I'm going to actually look more into Wednesday, or today if you're listening, and Thursday. I'm going to look more into the Rhode Island-George Mason game for the women. I want to see Rhodey finally get their first loss, and I want to see Mason win. Daniel, I see your enthusiasm. I did call that Mason would win last Sunday. True.
I'll be at the game, so if Mason wins, you will see me jumping up and down on press.
I'm going to try to watch that. I think I'm going to also try to watch Fordham and Richmond on Wednesday, but I know Thursday I definitely will have my eyes set on UMass VCU, with UMass coming back home after being on the road for two games straight and playing in their annual field trip day game at noontime. I think that game's going to be a very energetic one, and it's going to be very loud. It's going to be like probably one of the loudest games all season, probably one of the most well-attended games all season. I will unfortunately not be able to be on press row that game because I have classes at 12. Literally, my class
just skip class. It's fine. You're not a student. It's fine.
No, my professor would not let me skip it. Although he would probably understand that I'm working, but unfortunately, he probably won't let me skip it. And then looking into the weekend, I will have to agree with basically all of Daniel's picks. Also, it's just. This weekend is Rhode Island's like bye week kind of deal, whatever kind of way we're talking about it. So this kind of gives the chance to the rest of the conference to kind of pick up a little bit and build momentum up, because playing against Rhode Island is probably going to be one of the toughest games we see all season. And Rhode Island's next game after that is against St. Joe's, and St. Joe's needs any momentum they can build right now. And the momentum they can build right now into that game is going to be like awesome. And have Mason beating Rhode Island tomorrow will really like help with the momentum shift. Whether or not they can pull it off or not, I don't know. Daniel, I'm praying that they can pull it off, because I think I would be going out of my mind and screaming in like joy in my dorm room down here. But I don't know how well my like neighbors are like that, but I don't care. But I will say, like, any games that we can watch on the women's side is going to be very momentum, like, momentum building into like next half of the season.
All right. I mean, that's a great slate. I think one, I don't know if you mentioned this, David, but I mean, one that I know I'll be watching, Fordham GW, because I'll be there.
I'll be there.
And I know David will be there. So yeah, we'll both be on press row. Always great. Always great when, you know, at least two A-10 talk folks are on press row for a regular season game. So that'll be really fun. Will you be wearing the pink blazer? Will that make an appearance?
Yes, it will. It will make an appearance. And Sam, can I book you for a halftime interview on the WRGW broadcast?
I would be more than honored. That would be great.
the there finest college sports radio station in the country.
And Sam, after you, the next interview on our halftime show, it'll be a big one. Daniel, you might know who it is, but it'll be a big one. So that's all I'm going to say.
Yep.
At the game after the Fordham game?
So I believe for the Duquesne game when they're at GW, they have almost 400,000 Twitter followers, the person who's going to come on. So that's all I'm going to say.
All right. That's a great way to tee it up. I mean, I guess you'll have to throw a link out on your Twitter. And you know, speaking of Twitter, after this podcast, make sure you follow all of us on Twitter to keep getting updates for all your favorite Atlantic 10 teams. Keep following A10 Talk on Twitter for, you know, an amalgamation of all of our content, both on Twitter and at a10talk.com. Keep listening to this podcast. And until then, we'll catch you guys next time.